The overwhelming sorrow of losing a child is something he had never felt firsthand. "I can't know what this is," he remembers feeling. He sequestered himself in a quiet corner of the public, composing music, scribbling verses, occasionally wandering the halls. The staff got used to seeing him pacing in his slippers. One day he realized that his inability to grasp the enormity of Alexander and Eliza's loss wasn't a barrier to writing the song. It was the song. "Once I got the line, there are moments that the words don't reach. I had the song," he says. He wrote it in a day. The power of It's Quiet Uptown was intact from its first day. Actors cried while singing it. The production team cried while listening to it. Andy couldn't bear to choreograph it, not with his daughter Sophia fighting cancer and getting sick on the way to school, and the whole family hoping the next round of chemotherapy would work. The most affecting part of the song, curiously enough, always tended to be its one consoling moment. Alexander and Eliza's reconciliation, which turns out to be more convincing than anyone dreamed possible that day in the conference room. Lynn credits lax orchestration with the moment's beauty. The music moves down, down, down for much of the song, creating what Lynn calls a hypnotizing effect. Then, a moment before the reconciliation, the band plays Lack's quick, bright, upward flourish. If you want to be technical about it, they play the song's root chord with an added ninth tone, the sound of yearning, of seeking release. When the full company sings the word forgiveness, men higher than the women, voices blending to form the song's root chord, you don't need to understand a word of English or a bit of music theory to grasp that Alexander and Eliza have found their way home. The song is loss, and then it's being able to forgive the loss, says Lynn. There's some kind of magic in that, too. The mystery of what lies beyond words, the unfathomable action of grief, are things that everyone associated with Hamilton reckoned with, and not just because the show explores them. On November 16, 2014, Oscar and Laurie Eustace's beloved son, Jack, died. He was 16 years old. The shock of the news, the enormity of the loss, left family, friends, colleagues, and the Hamilton company devastated and bewildered. Everyone thought, first, of what could be done to help the Eustace family, to ease even slightly the pain that they were feeling. Everyone thought, second, about a cruel coincidence of the schedule. Dance rehearsals were set to begin the very next day, which meant Oscar and Laurie were about to spend half a year or more in the world of a show that pivots on the loss of a child. It's Quiet Uptown had been wrecking people who weren't grappling with the death of an only son. What would it do to people who were? 2 weeks later, the full company assembled for the first sing-through of the show. The actors stood at music stands. Lack presided at the piano. Tommy, Andy, Jeffrey, Jill, and a few members of the public staff were situating themselves in folding chairs when Oscar and Laurie walked in. Only a few of the people in the room had seen them since Jack's death, so there were greetings, hugs, condolences. Hearing It's Quiet Uptown for the first time since their unimaginable loss was bound to be wrenching. It was wrenching. For everyone. When the sing-through ended, we offered words of consolation that were heartfelt but inadequate before a grief larger than anyone could comprehend. There was one thing that the Hamilton company didn't know that day. When Lynn had heard of Jack's death, he sent an email to Oscar and Laurie expressing his deepest condolences. He also sent the demo recording of It's Quiet Uptown. "If art can help us grieve, can help us mourn, then lean on it," he wrote. If they preferred to delete the song, he would understand. Oscar and Laurie did lean on it. In the rehearsal studio that afternoon, nobody knew that It's Quiet Uptown was the only song they had listened to in their first week of mourning. They had listened to it every day. Chapter 29. Containing a dialogue on ambition and some topical comments from David Brooks and Christopher Hayes. It sounds like something Lynn cooked up for dramatic purposes, but it really happened this way. In 1800, Thomas Jefferson ran for president with Aaron Burr as his de facto running mate. It was de facto because the screwy electoral system of the era didn't allow candidates to run as a ticket. Jefferson anticipated that he would win the most electoral votes, and Burr would come in second, which would make them president and vice president, respectively. Instead, the two men tied, and Burr, discovering that he'd like to be president after all, declined to step aside. The Federalists, who controlled the House of Representatives, now got to pick the winner. Just as Lynn dramatizes, they sought Hamilton's advice about which man to elevate. Jefferson, who Hamilton had called an atheist in religion and a fanatic in politics, or Burr, the embodiment of a daring and unprincipled ambition. Politically, if I were Hamilton and I have a choice between a guy who doesn't really believe anything and a guy who believes the opposite of what I believe, the smart thing is to go with the guy who doesn't believe anything, says David Brooks, the best-selling author and New York Times columnist. You can talk to that guy. You can work him over, agrees Chris Hayes, the host of MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes. It's not going to be that bad, says Brooks, and they both laugh. Hayes is among the country's leading liberals, and Brooks is among the country's leading conservatives. Both of them have a special relationship to Hamilton. Brooks had seen an early performance at the Public and written a glowing column that lifted the show off the arts pages and into the political conversation. Hayes has known Lynn since they were teenagers when they did plays together at Hunter College High School. Hayes remembers Lynn as just this classic frickin' generative compulsive genius who makes stuff, presents it to the world, makes more stuff, and is constantly full of schemes and projects. They are good friends. But, of course, Hamilton was not just a political office holder, continues Brooks. He was a believer in virtue. He had an ethical system. I find that really resonates for me, says Hayes. My grandfather was a right-wing conservative Catholic, someone who went to mass every day and hated communism. But I still feel like I'm his inheritor, because he really believed in something. As a reporter, I often feel closer to people who feel strongly about things on the opposite side from me than people who don't care. So that section in the show is super believable. I would have voted for Jefferson. I had invited Hayes and Brooks to see Hamilton again during its Broadway previews, then share a dinner, in hopes that they could unravel a mystery. In 1800, enough politicians took their cues from Alexander Hamilton that he might have swayed the outcome of a presidential election. But look around Capitol Hill today. Where are the Hamilton devotees in government now? My view is that Hamiltonians existed until Teddy Roosevelt, says Brooks. Hamilton used limited but energetic government to create mobility. But after Roosevelt, the debate became big government versus small government. So the Hamilton tradition got caught crossways. Neither party has room for him now, Brooks believes. Republicans have become allergic to government and can't see what Hamilton saw, that government can let more people into the system and help capitalism solve the structural problems it's facing. But Democrats balk at embracing somebody whose programs would create more opportunity for gifted upstarts at the expense of creating more misery for the people who can't excel. Hamilton said that if we have to make life harder for people who can't hack it, we're going to do that, says Brooks. The goal is greatness. The goal is greatness, but he says that as somebody who is a world historical genius, says Hayes. I have a certain deep affection for the brilliant outer borough striver, but I also recognize the limitations of that structure. My visceral emotional reaction is in favor of that system, but my intellectual bearings are that that's not a way to run a society. I would have thought it's the other way around, I say. Your head would say, strive. That's how you get greatness. And your heart would say, but a lot of people will be left behind. My heart is with the outer borough strivers, because that's the world I lived in, and so did Lynn, says Hayes. He's from Inwood. I am from the Bronx. We bonded over two things, We both love theater, and we took the express bus together. We were both sort of outsiders. Everything about that play we just saw is about an outer borough striver, and I get it in my goddamn blood cells. When I saw it for the first time, I told him, "You have managed to channel something in history that is our shared experience of this world, where we were getting on that bus every day, and we put our armor on and said we're going to slay." I didn't think about it in those terms then. I thought about it as going to Manhattan and being lucky. But that metabolism as an outer borough striver is so central to who I am and who Lynn is and how we grew up. And that play is a masterpiece of its expression. "That resonates for me," says Brooks. "I was raised by my grandfather, who grew up on the Lower East Side and then in the Bronx. His father came from Russia. He would say, 'You want to make it in the city?' That meant Manhattan, Midtown, the Upper East Side. In college, I had pictures of Madison Avenue in my dorm room. Now it seems pathetic, but that was the dream. That was Mecca, to make it in the city." The real conflict in Hamilton, Brooks and Hayes agree, lies deeper than the political disputes of the past or present. More than anything, the show is about Hamilton and Burr and their styles of ambition, says Hayes. How do you get to the top, and what's the most American way to do that? "Are you the operator or the crusader?" asks Brooks. Every single person walks out of the theater thinking about Hamilton and saying, "I want to have that kind of ambition." "Right," says Hayes. "Which is sort of deeply American, and that's why the show is universal. Because everyone wonders, are my dreams big enough? Am I really making the most out of my life?" Chapter 30. Further thoughts on ambition as it pertains to the playwright and the enigmatic Burr. Lynn the actor stood still, but Lynn the writer kept moving. One afternoon in July, he was holding a position on the walkway above the stage, hands on the railing. Howell Binkley needed to see him standing up there to adjust a lighting look. As Lynn waited, he got an idea. A more compelling way for Burr to introduce Hamilton's pamphlet about John Adams. Lynn called to Leslie, who was standing in his own pool of light downstage right, and proposed the new line. Leslie tried it a couple of times and liked it. Lack popped his head out of the orchestra pit, and Lynn explained it again. Lack liked it too. The change was formally incorporated just as Howell finished his cue. "Lynn, you can relax," somebody shouted from the audience. "No," he said, "I can't." Even after previews began and President Obama came through, work on the show continued. The company rehearsed in the afternoons and performed at night. Those were long days for the actors, especially for the one trying to finish revising the script. As other items got crossed off the to-do list and the company drew nearer and nearer to press performances, their traditional deadline for making changes to the show, Lynn had one more big puzzle to finish: how to dramatize the final confrontation between Hamilton and Burr. "The White Whale," Tommy calls their duel, "elusive, monstrous, unknowable." It was the last part of the show that clicked into place. Lynn and Tommy had known from the start that for any treatment of the duel to be dramatically satisfying, Burr had to seem like a worthy adversary. That meant that they needed to understand Burr and his motivations, which was no easy task. Before history labeled him a villain, he was an enigma, a man who puzzled even his associates. He is a grave, silent, strange sort of animal, insomuch that we know not what to make of him, wrote one contemporary. Actually, that was written by Aaron Burr, describing himself in the third person. The aspect of Burr's persona that seemed most difficult to convey had come the most easily: his strange magnetism. On stage and off, Leslie was soft-spoken, self-contained, charismatic. Even his dressing room was perfectly appointed. But Lynn could see something beneath the savoir-faire of the actor, who castmates had nicknamed Silky. "Leslie's very smooth, but he's capable of real ferocity," he says. Leslie says he spent his early adulthood driving away the impulse to lose his cool. His serenity only seemed effortless. The 2 years he had spent mastering Lynn's songs and Andy's choreography had also been spent learning how to unleash his anger on stage and to enjoy it. In pre-Broadway rehearsals, Tommy worked with him on sharpening and simplifying what he did, finding small gestures that would have large impact. This required plenty of trust between actor and director. You have to hope that you're not whittling it to nothing or turning the volume down to a whisper for the whole show, Leslie says. In fact, when Leslie began performing at the Rogers, his depiction of Burr deepened and grew. He started to seem like Michael Corleone, a man whose power is intimidating precisely because it's held in check, one who doesn't need to raise his voice to convey the emotions churning within. The wider the contrast between Lynn's volubility and Leslie's restraint became, the more excited Lynn got about finding ways to exploit its power. In real life, the fatal animosity between Hamilton and Burr revealed itself in a series of letters in the summer of 1804. Burr, furious about a life of personal insults and political opposition, demanded that Hamilton explain the report that he made a despicable reference to him at a recent dinner. Lynn set Burr's peremptory challenge and Hamilton's condescending replies to music in Your Obedient Servant. In the downtown version of the song, he and Leslie had sniped at each other in a quick waltz tempo, a musical counterpart to the bizarre formality of vitriolic letters that ended with, Your Obedient Servant. Lynn rewrote the song for Broadway. He cut Burr's tempo in half. He made room for silence. At the Rogers, Leslie delivered his side of the exchange at a writing desk, still as a cobra. Burr looked and sounded ready to kill, but he didn't seem like a cliché villain of melodrama. In the show, as in real life, Hamilton really had insulted him, giving him legitimate grounds for fury. Leslie won praise for humanizing Burr and was gracious about sharing it. Lynn got inside his head first, he says. He saw Burr with love and compassion first. Lynn's identification with Burr mystified some people close to the show. His depiction of Hamilton's killer was more generous than virtually any other writer's. Even Gore Vidal's novel about Burr, which takes a remarkably friendly view of its hero schemes, finds room to call him a monster, a labyrinth, the slyest trickster of our time, and a man who makes even a trip to the barber seem like a plot to overthrow the state. At various points during the development of Hamilton, people wondered if Lynn might be overshooting the mark and making Burr too sympathetic. Lynn hinted at an explanation in a profile for The New Yorker when he told Rebecca Mead that he identified with Hamilton, but he had equal affinity with his killer. I feel like I have been Burr in my life as many times as I've been Hamilton. I think we've all had moments where we've seen friends and colleagues zoom past us, either to success or to marriage or to homeownership, while we lingered where we were, broke, single, jobless. And you tell yourself, wait for it. You don't expect to hear that kind of frustration from somebody who won a Tony at 28, an artist regarded as a valued collaborator by Stephen Sondheim, an esteemed fellow craftsman by John Kander, a respected fellow MC by Black Thought and Talib Kweli, a happy husband and father. Why do you identify with Burr so much? The question, asked over coffee a few weeks before Broadway opening night, takes Lynn back to his school days. Hunter is a very what-you-get place, he says. He looks into my mug as if it were a freshly graded paper. What'd you get? What'd you get? He remembers when a friend started taking high school-level math classes when they were still in middle school, something Lynn couldn't do, no matter how hard he tried. But after Hamilton, you can retire the Burr perspective, right? No, he says. It's not like a jacket I can take off. He is smiling, but he's serious. Yeah, but you wrote Hamilton. I've read your press. I have so much to do. High-octane strivers don't operate in a vacuum. There are all those other high-octane strivers around. Until the country has enough brass rings for everyone to grab, and maybe even then, being Alexander Hamilton, the all-American overachiever, also means being Aaron Burr, restless, watchful, unsatisfied. So you're still going to write like you're running out of time? Because I am. Chapter 31. How the duel was fought and rewritten and fought again as the clock ran out. Two bullets flew. That much is clear. One made a harmless journey through a cedar tree 12 feet off the ground. The other opened a hole 2 inches wide in the abdomen of Alexander Hamilton. Every other important aspect of his duel with Aaron Burr is a murky matter of speculation. Who shot first? Who aimed where? Why? In script meetings throughout the show's development, brisk conversations about the best way to stage this or that scene would slow and sometimes halt when those few seconds in Weehawken came up. Then the room would begin to sound like a history seminar, as people compared diverging accounts, weighed evidence, and began a lot of sentences with, or maybe. Lynn and his collaborators could draw on 2 eyewitness accounts to the duel. Accounts that don't agree. Nathaniel Pendleton, Hamilton's second for the duel, said Hamilton only pulled the trigger reflexively after being struck. That is why, on the boat ride back to New York, the stricken Hamilton warned people to be careful with his gun. He thought it was still loaded. But Burr's second, William P. Van Ness, said that Hamilton clearly fired first, and of course he aimed at Burr, he just missed. If that is true, then Hamilton got what he had coming at the hands of a deadlier rival. Lynn decided to ignore both these accounts and listen to Hamilton himself. In a letter to be opened after his death, he explained that he didn't want to fight Burr. He claimed to have a religious scruple against dueling and was only going through with it because of a public prejudice in favor of the practice. If he refused, he would lose his usefulness in future crises that were sure to threaten his beloved union. He had to go to Weehawken, and he had to hold a loaded gun, but he didn't have to fire it at Aaron Burr. But this only cracked open another more vexing set of questions. How could Hamilton be so cavalier about his possible death? Was the duel an elaborate way to commit suicide, as some historians believe? He was grief-stricken over Philip's death, a tragedy that also drove his daughter Angelica mad. Or maybe he saw the duel as a way to secure his legacy, a final expression of what Lynn called his martyrdom death wish. Or maybe Hamilton was playing a badass game of chess, wagering that his death would take the dangerous Burr off the board forever. Throughout 2013 and 2014, Lynn's collaborators waited to learn which of these theories he would endorse. His decision would determine how they would depict that baffling morning in Weehawken, which was sure to be the climax of the night. When Lynn finally made up his mind about the question, he picked an option that nobody expected. He wasn't going to answer it. "It's not a whodunit to me, this story," he says. "I'm not interested in weighing pros and cons. And I don't think we really think that way as humans. I don't think we go, this, 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 and this, and so I'm going to fire into the air." When you're in that adrenalized state, I think there's a lot of things at play. Just before the run at the public, Lynn wrote lines for Hamilton that traced a thought as it pinged around in his brain. Time would stop, and Hamilton would think about the prospect of imminent death. "I don't run or fire my gun, I let it be," he would say. And though he wouldn't explain his decision, he would announce it. "I've got to throw away my shot." The lines would rhyme, but there would be no music behind them. In other words, at the climax of the show, Lynn veered away from hip-hop and revived the old methods of verse drama, the same ones that Shakespeare used to give shape and order to jumbled thoughts. Lynn said that he was very happy with how it played off Broadway. Most people were. Oscar wasn't. Lynn has a resistance to wrapping it up neatly or explaining things or closing it off, and I admire that, he says. I told him at one point, "You know, I have the same notes for you I have for Shakespeare." He refuses to tell you. The problem, as Oscar saw it, is that a character who defined himself in Act One by his refusal to throw away his shot needed to tell the audience what changed in him that made him do the opposite when his life was on the line. Once the show got on its feet at the Public, Lynn and Tommy began having regular meetings with Oscar and Jeffrey to discuss script revisions. Jeffrey brought to the conversation his expertise with Broadway musicals, knowing how certain moments needed to pop for an audience of 1,300 people. Oscar brought his expertise as a dramaturge, his insistence that characters define themselves through their choices. He used those meetings to stay on Lynn about the duel. Both of them used the same phrase to describe his dramaturgical technique, pushing and pushing. Oscar kept it up throughout the spring and into the summer, even after the Broadway run began. In late July, he tried one last approach. He asked Lynn, "What if it's not a fait accompli at the top of the duel? That is, what if Hamilton goes into the duel intending to throw away his shot, but still wrestling with the decision?" Lynn perked up. "To me, that is inherently more dramatic," he says. A few days before the critics arrived, Lynn rewrote half a dozen lines that changed the whole song. Statements turned into questions. Instead of merely reviewing his life, Hamilton now searched it for the answer to his newly stated dilemma. Do I run or fire my gun or let it be? Lynn's performance changed along with the text. At the Public, he had sounded defiant when delivering his final line, "Raise a glass to freedom." Now he sounded vulnerable, unsure. When the bullet struck, people in the audience gasped. "That's exactly what you want when you're producing Romeo and Juliet," Lynn says. "Juliet, just wake up before he drinks the thing. And we know what's going to happen. We know they're both going to die, but if it's a good production, you gasp anyway. And that's what we're after here." By Oscar pushing and pushing, he got us to a place where we get the audience gasping. Of course, Hamilton is only half the duel. Burr, ever inscrutable, presented his own puzzles. Did he go to Weehawken to scare Hamilton? Or was he carried away by rage? Or was he really a sociopath, seeking to murder a rival in cold blood? Just as Lynn decided to leave some of Hamilton's motivation unexplained, Leslie made no ultimate decision about Burr. In fact, Leslie isn't sure, from night to night, which version of Hamilton's killer is going to show up. "If I'm not shocked by the way the show ends, I'm not happy," he says. "I want the thing to feel off the rails and alive." After 6 years of writing and rewriting and staging and restaging, a process that ended mere days before time ran out, Hamilton and Burr's duel remains mysterious, even to the actors performing it. Chapter 32. What is a legacy, or a sketch of opening night, and what came after, and what might come next? Lynn couldn't see the people, but the people could see Lynn. He entered at the back of the stage and strode all the way to the front. "What's your name, man?" asked Leslie, and he replied, "Alexander Hamilton." The audience roared. For 27 seconds, he stood there, bombarded by a crowd he couldn't see. Afterwards, he compared the sensation to death, the bright lights, the screaming, the void. Finally, he gave a slight nod to signal they had better let him finish the song. It was August 6th, 2015, and the opening night performance of Hamilton had begun. The first time Lynn performed that song publicly, there had been a few hundred people in front of him at the White House, and he had only Lack by his side. Now, there were 1,300 people in the audience, 20 other performers on stage, 10 musicians in the pit, and a dozen dressers and stage managers backstage. All of them turned the dial all the way up that night, trying to make it the best possible show for their families and the various VIPs. It wasn't the most technically precise performance, but it was the most impassioned. The room where it happens, which had grown into precisely the showstopper that Andy hoped it would be, got applause before it ended. Nearly 3 hours later, Lynn exited the way he had entered, disappearing upstage after the duel. But Hamilton's death doesn't end his story. The last song in the show captures the bitter historical truth that every one of Hamilton's enemies outlived him, and they did all that they could to efface his memory. By ending with Hamilton's afterlife, not his death, the show asks us to think about what we leave behind when we're gone. It invites us to think about legacies. Hamilton thought about them a lot. So does Lynn. I think we all dream, or it might just be me, that when we pass on, the people we love are going to keep us alive in some way, whether that's talking about us or keeping our picture up, he says. He thinks about his grandfather, who lived in a small town in Puerto Rico, occupying a position roughly equivalent to George Bailey's in It's a Wonderful Life. When he died, crowds of mourners filled the streets. Like the beginning of a vida, Lynn says. He thinks, too, about the legacy of his father, Luis, who has spent decades as a political consultant and activist, who has helped to get mayors elected, who was a constant presence around the show during its development. My dad will shut down New York when he dies, or at least Latino New York, political New York, he says. As the show depicts, there was widespread grief when Hamilton died, but it passed quickly, leaving his legacy to be protected by one person, Eliza. She lived for 50 years after his death and devoted them to maintaining his reputation, to publishing his papers, to reminding future generations of what he had achieved. Serving his legacy didn't just mean commemorating him, though. It also meant continuing his work. She crusaded against slavery, as Hamilton had, and this widow of an orphan helped to found the first private orphanage in New York. That's the real power of legacy. We tell stories of people who are gone because, like any powerful stories, they have the potential to inspire and to change the world. A new thought about legacies struck Lynn on opening night, and several hundred people got to watch it happen. He presented that day's Ham for Ham show, the short performance that one or several company members or surprise guests give outside the theater to entertain people who had entered the lottery for front row seats. In honor of opening night, he returned to the place where his Hamilton experience had started. He read the first few pages of Ron Chernow's book, an account of Eliza's lonely struggle on behalf of Alexander's legacy. He had read these passages dozens of times, but that day, he started to cry. Her whole life was to have her husband's story be told. And we're about to open this big, honking Broadway musical about him, he says. On opening night, standing under the Rogers marquee, he realized that if Eliza's struggle was the element of Hamilton's story that had inspired him the most, then the show itself was part of her legacy. To borrow an image from his script, she had planted seeds in a garden that she didn't get to see, and one of them turned out to be Hamilton. Is the ghost of Alexander Hamilton nonplus that a New Yorkian kid has written a giant musical about his life? Probably, says Lynn. He's going to go, what's a New Yorkian? A caravan of double-decker buses was ferrying the audience across town and down the West Side Highway when the reviews went online. The consensus was that Hamilton had grown more polished and more powerful in its uptown incarnation, that it was radical, stunning in its audaciousness, vibrantly democratic, and audaciously ambitious. Somehow, it really did live up to its mountainous hype. Nobody seemed to mind that it wasn't 15 minutes shorter than it had been at the Public. The buses deposited everyone at Chelsea Piers, a sports and fitness complex along the Hudson River. For Jeffrey, the choice of Pier 60, the hangar-sized party space, had been instinctive. He has been throwing opening night parties there since Rent back in 1996. But since he thinks that Hamilton is the best show he's produced, he was motivated to make it the best opening night party he had thrown. It meant, among other things, that only one band would do. The Roots. The best live act in hip-hop tore the place up. One love, one game, one desire, rapped Black Thought. One flame, one bonfire, let it burn higher. At the end of an hour-long set, he looked over at the dancing crowd, several hundred strong, and said, "Where's my man, Lin-Manuel Miranda?" Lin was standing directly in front of the stage, wearing a dark suit, his hair in a ponytail, Travolta in Pulp Fiction, but Puerto Rican. Hands pushed him onto the stage. For the third time that day, he turned to face an audience. He looked delighted, also alarmed. Black Thought handed him a mic. Questlove laid down a beat, and Lin's freestyling instincts kicked in. "I worked for 7 years. These are the fruits," he rapped. "I'm standing on stage with the fucking Roots." Everybody screamed. Rapping alongside giants of hip-hop was only the most visible sign on how radically Lin's life had changed. "This puts my dreams to shame," he said of the whole experience in a laudatory segment on 60 Minutes, the existence of which underscores the point he was making. Thanks to Hamilton, the word genius started popping up in front of his name before he was named a MacArthur Genius Fellow. Extraordinarily eminent people started inviting him to do things, to go places, to write this, to say that. "Performing 7 shows a week can be a grind," he says, "but it also grants him 7 pockets of peace in this hurricane of a life." Many of his castmates can tell similar stories. For all the subtle, long-aborning things that will change because of Hamilton, the revolution in some of their lives has been immediate and profound. By opening night, Pippa, Leslie, Renee, David, and the rest were becoming stars. People wanted to know about the clothes they wore, where they ate, what kind of music they listened to. They appeared on magazine covers. They went to stadiums to sing national anthems. "I get to be in rooms I have no business being in," Anthony says. He can't put into words how he feels. He mimes his forehead, blowing up. A voice on the PA system invited everybody to move on to the long platform that runs along the edge of Pier 60, facing the Hudson. 1,000 people streamed out into the dark. Considering the story that brought everybody together that night, walking out there felt like a pilgrimage. If you had been standing on this exact spot in the early hours of July 11th, 1804, you would have seen Alexander Hamilton being rowed from a Manhattan pier downstream on your left to the dueling grounds of Weehawken upstream on your right. In fact, if you had waved to him, he might have waved back, for we know that he was looking at New York on that journey. One of his last observations before Burr shot him was to reflect on his city and how much it had grown, and his great hopes for the people who would find their way there, as he had. The crowd out there, on this night, was a happy jumble of celebrities, producers, spouses, press, and friends. Lin and Tommy were laughing about something, or everything. Andy stood behind his wife Ellie, hugging her and beaming. They had learned that the chemo had worked, and their daughter Sophia was going to be fine. A few people pointed out something unusual about this opening night. Lots and lots of parents of Hamilton cast members had come to celebrate what their children had made. Lin's mother and father came from Upper Manhattan, and Anthony's came from Brooklyn. Jasmine's father came from Manhattan, and her mother from upstate. Neil's parents drove down from Buffalo. Those were just the New Yorkers. Stephanie's parents came from New Jersey, so did Oak's mom. Pippa's parents came from Chicago, as did Austin's. Carly's mother came up from Delray Beach, Florida, and Ephraim's came from West Palm Beach, and Ariana's came from Raleigh, North Carolina. Leslie's parents came up from Philly, Sasha's from Macon, Georgia, Renee's father came from Detroit, and her mother from Houston. David's mother came from Northern California, Andrew's came from Southern, and Voltaire's came from Bakersfield, which is in between. Chris's mother came from his hometown, Cairo, Illinois, and Alicia's from hers, Dallas, and Seth's from his, in Ohio. Plot those places on a map, and you'd see that the company drew on extraordinarily talented performers who hailed from all over America. They worked insanely hard to get to opening night, and the parents who came to cheer them on sacrificed God knows what to make it possible for them to have a career in the first place. Every performance of Hamilton features 21 performers giving 21 performances, and each one is a legacy in its own right. No wonder it was such a good party. All those mothers and fathers would have one more story to tell when they got home. Jeffrey had ordered up fireworks. In a final flurry of creativity, Lynn had put together a playlist to go with them. He mixed up all sorts of styles, but he put special emphasis on New York anthems of every variety. Old ones like Frank Sinatra's rendition of New York, New York. New ones like Jay-Z and Alicia Keys' Empire State of Mind. Even a very new one. The Schuyler Sisters. It sounded right at home in that company. The music started, the show began, everybody cheered, and lots of people sang along. The sky flashed and the river turned colors. It looked like the 4th of July. Epilogue. The black first president exited. The first black president appeared. On November 2, 2015, Chris Jackson and his castmates stood gaping off stage left as Barack Obama entered from stage right. The president, the real one, not the one Chris plays in the show, smiled and waved, waiting for the entrance applause to end. "What did I miss?" he said. It would have blown the powder clear off George Washington's wig to imagine a half-Kenyan man becoming president. Yet there was Obama, his 43rd successor, raising funds to help elect his 44th. Democratic Party officials had arranged a special performance of Hamilton, guessing that donors would pay generously to see the hottest show in New York. They guessed right. It meant that 6 years after Lynn had gotten a boost from his association with the White House was, improbably, getting a boost from Lynn. Obama teased the audience about it. "You write a check and you listen to some boring politician talking, now that's commitment," he said. "Coming to this show? You don't get special props for this." Obama rallied the troops that night by reviewing his legacy. This touched off another bout of historical vertigo. Didn't we just watch a president sum up his legacy when Chris sang Washington's farewell address at the end of One Last Time? Past and present seemed to be tumbling together, a shimmery double exposure. But the president had an aim beyond reviewing the incidents of my administration, as Lynn had said on stage about 45 minutes earlier. Obama wanted to make an argument about change and how it comes to America. To do so, he turned to Hamilton again and again for illustration. Part of what's so powerful about this performance is it reminds us of the vital, crazy, kinetic energy that's at the heart of America. That people who have a vision and a set of ideals can transform the world, he said. Every single step of progress that we've made has been based on this notion that people can come together and ideas can move like electricity through them and a world can change. This is a community organizer's vision of progress, one that Obama has advanced since before he became president. In the 2004 speech that made him a national figure overnight, he insisted that in spite of our outward differences, there's not a black America and a white America and a Latino America and an Asian America. There's the United States of America. One measure of America's health, then, is how warmly it embraces the diverse souls who live here. Obama found this spirit in Hamilton as well. The idea of America that was represented here was more than just numbers, more than just statistics. It's about who we are, who's seen, who's recognized, whose histories are affirmed. In spite of all the similarities between his worldview and the show's, Obama didn't try to claim it for a single political party. "It is," he said, "the only thing that Dick Cheney and I agree on." What's really striking, though, is the fact that Obama could locate so many parallels to his ideas in a historical drama. Hamilton depicts events that happened a long time ago. Its ideas are, by definition, old. Why, then, do so many people greet them as bold and revelatory when Obama says them? For that matter, why do so many different kinds of people leave a performance of Hamilton feeling newly connected to their country? Unless Lin made the whole thing up, and nobody has said he did, it suggests that however innovative Obama's speeches and Lin's show might seem, they are, in fact, traditional. They don't reinvent American character. They renew it. They remind us of something we forgot, something that fell as far out of sight as the posthumously neglected Alexander Hamilton, who spent his life defending one idea above all, the necessity of union to the respectability and happiness of this country. Obama's speeches and Lin's show resonate so powerfully with their audiences because they find eloquent ways to revive Hamilton's revolution, the one that spurred Americans to see themselves and each other as fellow citizens in a sprawling, polyglot young republic. It's the change in thought and feeling that makes all the other changes possible. The Obama presidency will end in January 2017. But the show that shares so much of its spirit will keep running. At the Rogers that night, the president all but anointed Hamilton as a keeper of the flame. His primary message, he said, was to remind people of the need to keep hoping and to work together, but this performance undoubtedly described it better than I ever could. The most important affinity that Hamilton will carry into its future isn't a specific message, though. Political or otherwise, it's an underlying belief in stories and their power to change the world. Good community organizer that he is, the president knows that stories can be an engine for empathy and a way to show people what they share. It's why he introduced himself in that first big speech in 2004 by telling his own story. In the years to come, some of the many, many kids who are going to see and even perform Hamilton will be newly inspired to tell their stories too. Every time they do, the newly kaleidoscopic America will understand itself a little more. I can do that, they'll say. And if they're like Alexander Hamilton, they'll add, and I can do it better. Continue listening to hear Lin-Manuel Miranda's narration of his notations to the libretto that can be found on the PDF that accompanies this audiobook.
Act 1. Alexander Hamilton. 1. Before we even begin, a musical note. The piano riff that begins this show is actually inspired by a beat I made. I wanted the sound of a door slamming as the downbeat. And in my computer music program, I grabbed a sound file called Door Wood Squeak. The sound of the wood squeak was so compelling, I set it to notes. Hence the opening riff. Okay, let's keep going. 2. This was originally written as a Burr monologue when Hamilton was still a concept album in my head. It wasn't until we realized we were writing a musical that we began to divvy up the monologue among the people who bore witness to Hamilton's life. This owes a debt to the prologue of Sweeney Todd. All our characters set the stage for our main man's entrance. 3. It's up to the Treasury Department whether we get to keep this lyric or not. As of this printing, Hamilton's the dude on the $10 bill. 4. At the top of every musical, it's essential to establish the world. Hamilton's early life was marked by trauma and a first-hand view of the brutal practices of the slave trade. 5. This is a beautiful letter. Look it up. My favorite phrase in it is that the scene was sufficient to strike astonishment into angels. 6. From the very beginning, this was how I sang his name. It's an absurdly musical name. 7. We double the tempo here because Hamilton's found his way out. He's going to double down on his education and make himself undeniable. The image in my head is of Harry Potter finding out he's a wizard. Everything suddenly makes sense. 8. Those who have seen my White House performance will note that these lyrics used to be, in our cowardice and our shame, we will try to destroy your name. Over the course of the show's development, we realized that the story would be told not only by his enemies, but by his friends and loved ones. Friend or foe, they're in awe of him. 9. Of course, the actors who play Mulligan and Lafayette fight with him as friends in Act 1 and fight with him as his enemies, Madison and Jefferson, in Act 2. It's also true of Lawrence Phillip, who dies for him in both acts. I was very proud of myself for the double meanings in this section, hence this note. Aaron Burr, sir. 1. I know every word that rhymes with Burr. It's a long list. I tried to use all of them in this show. The rhymes with Hamilton list is non-existent, so. 2. This is, of course, a fictional first meeting between Hamilton and Burr, and I centered it around a rather remarkable fact. Burr graduated from college crazy young and fast. What he's not telling Hamilton, his father was the president of the college. Privilege plays a role. But Hamilton doesn't know that. What he knows is that Burr graduated fast, and Hamilton has no money and no time to waste. 3. Chernow blanched a bit at this historical leap. Hamilton wasn't needlessly violent, but the rhyme was too good to pass up. 4. France's Tavern, of course, still exists. They've got great hot toddies in the winter. 5. This whole section is basically Harry Potter meeting Draco Malfoy before meeting his real friends. Just Hamilton's luck to meet his temperamental opposite. 6. An homage to the amazing subway breakdancers of NYC circa present day who start their shows this way. 7. This is a love letter to old school hip hop. I'm blank blank in the place to be is so old school. It was a staple of the first raps I ever wrote as a kid. 8. I think Lafayette wants to rap in French now. I have to go learn some French. Damn it, Lafayette. Me, tweeting in 2013. 9. Listen, Mulligan didn't grow up to be a statesman like Lafayette or Hamilton, but his name is just the best rapper moniker I ever heard in my life. So he gets the most fun punchlines. I don't know what his thing is with horses, but I thought it was funny. 10. Those who stand for nothing fall for anything. This is a paraphrase of a line often misattributed to Alexander Hamilton. It was said by a later Hamilton in the 20th century. But the sentiment is so perfect for this moment, and so well underscores the difference between Hamilton and Burr, I flipped it for the occasion. My shot. 1. And Tupac responds, "Holla if you hear me!" 2. Mobb Deep's greatest lyric revisited here. 3. This is the big pun effect, stacking internal rhymes into lyrics so densely and making them feel conversational. 4. This cadence is used by the Notorious B.I.G. in Going Back to Cali when spelling his own name. I'm calling on all the East Coast rap gods in this verse. 5. Some have pointed out that I also rhymed spending spree in the Heights. Totally accidental, but true. What is it with me and spending sprees? 6. Stage direction humor. 7. I love writing for Lafayette because it allows me to indulge something I have found to be true in my own life. Those for whom English is a second language are capable of fantastic, outside-the-box thinking with our language. 8. Latin humor. 9. This is a shout-out to You've Got to Be Carefully Taught from South Pacific, a Rodgers and Hammerstein classic about racism. As Lawrence and the boys rap about equality, Burr comes in with some cold reality. 10. And here's Hamilton, synthesizing everything his friends have said and going further. This song took years to write, and here's why. We have to systematically prove that Hamilton is the most fearsome intellect in the room, not just by saying so, but by demonstrating it. 11. This lyric used to be Lawrence yelling, "Don't this shit make my people want to rise up?" A nod to Busta Rhymes' refrain in Pass the Crevassier. Once we learned that clearing this sample was fiscally prohibitive, I built the new lyric around Anthony Ramos' voice. He's a crooner at heart, and his bravado is unmatched. I'm really glad I got to suit it to his strengths. 12. This verse took the better part of a year to write. It's the Rosetta Stone of Hamilton's brain, and the first line of it is the most autobiographical thing I've ever written. It's what I feel I have most in common with Hamilton. The ticking clock of mortality is loud in both our ears, and it sets us to work. In this verse, he goes from nihilism to a list of what needs to be done to hope towards tomorrow, and he takes himself there through one uninterrupted train of thought. 13. Continuing the rhyme at the top of the next line, this is what Big Pun does so well. It knits all his rhymes together. I play with it a lot in this show, and this is my favorite one. 14. And this is one of the big punnest lines in the show. Multiple five-syllable rhymes inside the line. 15. So how do you build an ending like this? Endless conversations with Tommy, Alex Lacamoire, and Andy Blankenbuehler. Seriously, so many versions of different counterpoints to build to just the right finish. In these meetings, I find I'm more the editor than the writer. Alex will have 50 musical ideas, Andy will have 50 staging ideas, and Tommy and I will sift them in the middle. It's like this for most of the buttons in the show. The story of tonight. 1. I wrote this melody when I was 16 years old. I had a doo-wop group with 4 other friends, and I'd written this song called I've Got a Bridge to Sell You. When it came time to write this number for the show, that melody did everything I wanted this scene to do. It conveyed a yearning and innocence I felt in finding a group of friends to sing with me. 2. Yes, these lyrics are foreshadowing, but they're no more dire than most pub drinking songs. 3. I've got a bridge to sell you. C note at top of scene. 4. Tommy and I discussed using this song as a theme that would keep coming back as we checked in with these young men. We took our cue from Sondheim's Merrily We Roll Along, where the core trio of friends repeatedly sings, Here's to us, who's like us, damn few. This theme will mutate as time wears on and people fall away, but here it is in its first full blush. The pen and the pad 1. Top left. This is my outline of Act 1. Everything in brackets refers to a song that does not yet exist, but can connect slash fill in what's there. Lady's musical moment became the Schuyler Sisters. Hamiltonia was an idea for an actual moment when Hamilton came home to New York and was greeted as a hero. It was a nice historical moment, but we needed to keep moving. Top right. These are my character notes for the Sons of Liberty for the second verse of My Shot. Bottom. I wrote this song on my honeymoon, without a piano, and it took a while for the melody to settle. This version is close to the final form. Even though the lyrics are different, you can see I've got my head around the existing melody. Bottom. Early draft of Hamilton's Helpless rap. Peggy hadn't arrived yet, but the pieces are all there and waiting to gel. The Schuyler Sisters. 1. This is our one short day in the Emerald City. It's a love letter to New York, and it lets us know who the Schuyler Sisters are outside the context of Hamilton and his future affections. 2. Union Square didn't exist in its current form yet, but I wanted that kind of feel, a place where you could find any type of New Yorker in the same place. Talking to Cher now got me to the Common, a square downtown. 3. Poor Peggy. She doesn't stick around the story long enough to merit a musical motif. She married rich and died young, in case you're wondering where she is in Act 2. 4. Our little Jay-Z Pharrell homage. 5. This is my wife's favorite line in the show. 6. When this was still an album in my head, I really wanted the rapper Common Sense to read a selection of Common Sense. I am nothing if not literal. 7. She did, of course, meet Jefferson in Paris and corresponded with him later in life. It kills me that I couldn't fit that detail in the show. So here it is in this book. 8. I tell myself this every day. It was nice to give it to Eliza. Farmer Refuted. 1. I began with the harpsichord progression and wrote this melody and lyrics rather quickly. None of this is in Seabury's writings. 2. The fun and laborious part of this tune was having Hamilton dismantle Seabury using the same vowels and cadences and talking over him. Heed becomes heed. Rabble, unravel. Heart, hard to listen to you, etc. It felt like the kind of superpower Hamilton could deploy to impress his friends. 3. I have a lot of family in Jersey. When I kid, it's with love. 4. Meta joke. I love this joke. It just showed up. You'll be back. 1. I was having a drink with Hugh Laurie, with whom I'd worked on his series House, and I told him I wanted to write a breakup letter from King George to the colonies. Without blinking, he improvised at me, Oh, you'll be back, wagging his finger. I laughed and filed it away. Thanks, Hugh Laurie. 2. The Boston Tea Party reference. Blink and you miss it. 3. I wrote this song on my honeymoon in the South Pacific. I'd already had the idea, but as my wife and I walked around these amazing islands, I started hearing King George and singing to myself. This whole tune was written without a piano, just a melody in search of its moorings. 4. I just love that King George has a clever turn of phrase on subject and beats it into the ground. 5.
He did.
Right-hand man. 1. This section used to live at the middle of the song, but it's much more effective at the top. Imagine the waterways around New York surrounded by an armada so thick it chokes out the sky.